evening and welcome, friends, to Voices of the Sacred Feminine, whether you're across town or across the globe. Thank you for joining me tonight and spending your valuable time with me and my wonderful guests. Tonight, our opening song by Diva Haley from her Sacred Alchemy CD is called Aphrodite, in tribute to tonight's second guest, Lorelei Black, who's back for part two of our discussion about this incredible goddess who so many misunderstand is just the goddess of love and beauty. If you caught our first interview a few weeks ago, you understand she's not just a boudoir babe. Tonight, my discussion with Lorelei continues on the subject of priestessing, initiation, and looking to the future of aphrodisian worship. And as serendipity would have it, we are also talking about priestessing with my first guest, Anne Key, also returning to the show, discussing her book, Memoir of a Priestess, and we'll be sharing what it was like for her and her role as a priestess of the Sekhmet Temple outside Las Vegas and lots of other stuff. But first, I have to get to the bees that are buzzing round in my bonnet. Okay, I know it's kind of cheesy, but I like that. I can't really move on without talking about the election only a week ago. It was such an important milestone in our history toward trying to forge a more caring economy. And I believe, as I've written in my Examiner column and for several blogs, that the election signaled sacred feminine ideals are still on the rise. You know, I don't know if you felt the same way as I did. It seemed touch and go there for a while, especially after the first debate when Romney fooled people by shaking his Etch-a-Sketch, then seemed to pick up some momentum. My stomach was in knots with his bump in the polls, but I kept hanging on to Nate Silver's predictions that Obama would win the necessary Electoral College votes and Rachel Maddow's nightly reports that President Obama was leading in the swing state polls, which was where it really counted. But, you know, we were hearing stuff like Mercury was going into retrograde and we might not know the outcome of the election for weeks. I was preparing myself for more voter suppression, dirty tricks, and another Supreme Court appointment, another steal by the Republicans. But then we got a few good debates under our belt. Some even said Mother Nature herself stepped in the guise of Hurricane Sandy to show Americans we need each other, we are a collective, and government can work. Some of the most cynical Republicans saw that firsthand, and, you know, they were only too eager to reach out to the government services that were sometimes so quick to want to defund or abolish. The weeks and months leading up to November 6th felt endless, certainly like a nail biter if you were listening to the news. Then Election Day was here, and it was over so quick. Ohio voters put President Obama over the top, and Republicans are still reeling from their rejection by American voters. But that's already the past now, if you can believe it. What a difference just a week makes. Just a few days. Well, several days later, you know, we're filled with hope that right can defeat might, that the light prevails over darkness, and sacred feminine ideals are still what the majority of people want. The GOP, including Romney, well, they're saying Obama bribed the electorate with gifts. What gifts? I didn't get any gifts. Do they mean in an attempt at a fair government? And what about the gift they were giving to the 1% with even more tax cuts? It's really pretty insane. Bill O'Reilly over there at Fox, well, he's saying the president got elected by all the takers out there who want stuff. And you know what? He's right. Only he seems to have the context of the stuff wrong. Yes, we want our electoral, our educational system funded. We want investments in infrastructure and job creation. We want to keep the EPA so we have clean air and water. We want assurances we aren't going to go bankrupt because we get sick or can't get medical coverage because of pre-existing conditions. Obamacare morphing into a single-payer system or Medicare for all would be perfect. Thank you, Mr. O'Reilly. We want a social safety net that guarantees we can retire in dignity and security. We want equality for women and human rights for gay people. We want immigrants to get a fair shake. We want peace and our liberty stolen under the Bush administration restored. We want fairness in the tax system and corporations to pay a tax penalty for outsourcing jobs. We want corporations to pay their fair share of taxes and the 1% too, and maybe even a bit more because they're the ones that can afford it. Imagine if all the money wasted by the billionaires to buy our democracy, they're saying it's $400 billion, had been put toward job creation and helping people out of poverty or aided our crumbling infrastructure. Yeah, we want stuff like peace instead of war and our tax dollars spent on Americans and not the military-industrial complex and corporate welfare for oil companies. We want more regulation of out-of-control corporations and banks that care nothing about anything but short-term profits and their bottom line. And you know what, Mr. O'Reilly? There's stuff we don't want, too. Student loans the size of home mortgages. And no, we aren't fooled anymore with phony promises of trickle-down economics. It works for no one but the rich who aren't trickling anything down. We don't want income disparity in this country or one religion with the power to legislate their beliefs upon us all. We don't want any of the stuff the Republicans are peddling, vaginal probes in women's wombs, the defunding of Planned Parenthood, the destruction of Obamacare and Roe v. Wade. Neither do we want a war with Iran or more tax cuts for the 1% or Ayn Rand's survival of the fittest ideas because the playing field out there is not fair or balanced. We don't want a government so small it can be drowned in the bathtub because that's a government that does nothing but fight wars and give corporations and billionaires all the breaks. We don't want political leaders hell-bent on perpetuating racism, homophobia, sexism, environmental destruction, lies and fear, or denying science and inconvenient facts. Yes, we do want to reshape the patriarchal world because it's leading us to the brink of destruction. We do want to complement the ideals of the authoritarian father with the ideals of the mother, partnership, negotiation, fairness, nurturing, caring, compassion, wisdom, freedom, justice, equality, peace, and truth, the empowerment of women, diversity, tolerance, and getting back to what nature teaches us, that things grow not from the top down, but from the bottom up. That's a world with the sacred feminine, deity, archetype, and ideal restored at the center, a world dedicated to the moral imperative of our time, the empowerment and the equality of women. But, my dear listeners, don't go to sleep out there. I know you're weary from this election, but the Republicans are already saying they believe what they were selling is really universal and what people all over want. They just didn't sell it well enough. Next time they said they need black and brown skin people to do the selling to bring in those votes. They aren't getting it that their platform has nothing for black and brown skin people or women, but they want to keep pushing that agenda. They haven't learned by this landslide of Obama's win, by their overwhelming defeat. They are in serious denial. They don't see that so many of us see them as a party that perpetuates sexism and racism, homophobia and environmental destruction and selfishness. They just don't see it. Next time they say they won't talk about the social issues. Well, in other words, it'll be like the 2010 election when the Republicans swept into office saying one thing but doing another. Maybe you remember. They swept in saying they'd create jobs, and they didn't. Instead, they obstructed any job bills proposed by the president because they counted on the unemployment rates working against President Obama and helping get them into office. Instead, they went on a spree to take away women's rights and worker rights. Remember, my dear listeners, leopards don't change their spots, as my mother always said. Remember. Well, if you're new to the show, I'm your hostess, Karen Tate, and I'm the author of two books, Sacred Places of Goddess, 108 Destinations, sold in all the usual places, but also in museum bookstores like the Getty, in Malibu, and the Chicago Field Museum. My other book, Walking Ancient Path, Rebirthing Goddess on Planet Earth, well, it won an award in the spirituality category. It's sort of a spiritual, socio-political look at embracing a goddess-inspired life. Oh, I'd say whether that's whether that's traveling to our sacred sites or you maybe just want to know why the sacred feminine is still relevant today as deity, archetype, or ideal. Ideals like women's rights, environmentalism and fairness, balance, partnership, truth and wisdom, women's spiritual authority and leadership, all of which we have to keep fighting for and not expect the president to deliver to us on his own without us pushing him. So take a break, nourish yourself, but get back to activism. We can never fall asleep again. So without further delay, let me say thanks to my first guest, Ann Key, for her patience during my opening here. And I'll start with telling you a little bit about Anne in case you're not acquainted with her yet. Anne Key, she's an adjunct faculty in women's studies and religious studies at the College of Southern Nevada. She's a graduate of the Women's Spirituality Program of California Institute of Integral Studies, where her investigation centered on Mesoamerica. She's a co-founder of the independent press, Goddess Inc. Dr. Key was priestess of the Temple of Goddess Spirituality dedicated to Sekhmet, located in Nevada, from 2004 to 2007. She's the author of Desert Priestess, a memoir, and she's co-editor of The Heart of the Sun, an anthology and exaltation of Sekhmet. And she resides in Albuquerque, New Mexico, with her husband, his four cats, and her snake. Well, Anne, welcome back.
Well, thanks, Karen, and well said on your introduction.
Oh, well, thank you so much. I'm glad you agree. You know, I think most of the women out there I know who are goddess advocates, we're all pretty much on the same page. You know, it's kind of hard for someone said it like this, a pagan can no more be a Republican than a Jew can be a Nazi. And, you know, I think that's true. If we care about women and fairness and in the environment and all of that sort of stuff, you know, we have to fight to take care of those things. And, we sure did. And I'm still kind of reeling from the win. I was not expecting it to come so soon or so easy. I thought we were going to have a fight on our hands.
Yeah, I think we're all relieved.
yeah, relieved. That's a good way to put it. Well, so Anne, tonight our show topic, A Memoir of a Priestess, and we're going to be discussing your book, Desert Priestess, A Memoir, and it's in both print and there's an audio format out there. So you were at the temple for 3 years. How did you come to actually be chosen by Genevieve, I presume, to priestess out there at the temple?
Yeah, it was one of those interesting sort of convergence of events that I had a career as a college administrator, and I was director of a department, and working my way up to dean of the school, academic dean. And I had a number of things happen. I had a few tragedies that sort of happened. I had my long-term relationship broke up. My father died and my house burned. And these things happened. And I lost my dissertation. My computer crashed and I lost all of my dissertation work. So in a few months period, a lot of things happened. And it really forced me to evaluate my life and my job. And
wow.
I decided to quit my career, and just work on my dissertation for a while. And in that period of time, I just got an email on our Women's Spirituality Listserv from CIIS that Genevieve was looking for a priestess. And if I had still been, you know, on my career track, I don't know that I would have quit at that point. But I had a real open slate, and so I went and interviewed with Genevieve in Austin. And I happened to be in Texas at the time because my sister lives in Austin, and I was staying with her during part of the time I was writing. And then interviewed with Patricia Perlman, the priestess at the time, there at the temple, and it was just kind of a perfect storm of events, really.
Wow. Well, you know, I don't know about you, but, you know, some very, very challenging things have happened to me in my life. And in the moment when you're dealing with them, you know, you sort of feel like the world is crashing in on you. But then when you move past them, at least for me, I could look back and say, wow, those challenges really helped me steel myself, helped me form who I am, you know, what I really believe. You know, you're kind of forced in that position. I mean, do you look back now? I mean, do you sort of feel, I mean, I don't know whether you look at goddess as deity, archetype, or ideal, but if you do look at her as deity, I mean, do you think she was trying to take you down a different path than you were maybe planning for yourself?
Yeah, there was definitely, you know, it was definitely not what I planned. I'm doing. And then I looked to it, a lot of the things that I had learned. I've also been a small business owner, and I used to own a coffee shop on the Oregon coast. And like I said, I've been a college administrator and a college professor. So I've done a lot of work with administering programs and dealing with things like people, like the physical plants. I mean, you know, just sort of the idea of buildings and money and budgets. And so I had a lot of experience that really are actually very important for a priestess, but I don't know that I would have put those things down at first if I hadn't done this before. Mm-hmm. But being able to get along with people and being able to hear people, mm-hmm. and being able to lead and being able to understand how to raise money, how to budget money, how to spend money, how to form a group and lead that group and help people in it become even more themselves, better. Mm-hmm. So a lot of those things in my careers before had helped me.
Helping prepare you to be able to step into that role.
Yeah.
Looking back on it, any regrets? You know, that life took such a different payoff?
No, you know, one always wishes, well, at least I always wish that I could have done, you know, a number of my paths. I'm going to turn 50 this July, and, you know, certainly it's a point in life when I say, well, if I had done those things, I wouldn't have done what I was able to do. And if I was the dean of a school and I wasn't an adjunct faculty member, I wouldn't have had a chance, I wouldn't have time to write books either,
right.
or form a publishing company, or
right.
any of the other, you know, things that I've been able to do by sort of having an alternative career. And so I think there's always a little bit of regret, but I have loved everything that I've done. So,
well, that's great.
And I'm pretty blessed. I mean, I've gotten to do... living out of the temple in the desert is just, for myself and actually for my husband, it was one of the most just absolutely blessed 3 years of our lives.
Wow.
So.
Well, and I would imagine you probably went through some transformation and, you know, your own personal evolution in those 3 years. I bet there was a lot of taking stock and soul searching and finding yourself.
Well, and I think one of the things that was one of my big breakthroughs was really understanding that strength comes from within.
Mm-hmm.
And especially being a spiritual leader for a religion that doesn't have a set liturgy, you know, a set tradition that everyone mm-hmm. sort of expects, I really had to know where I was coming from, where my pieces were. I had to really move to a place where I did not engage in projection of my own pieces.
Mm-hmm.
But and also, you know, I mean, a good friend of mine, also a priestess, said, the moment you say you're a priestess, it's like putting a target on your back.
In so many different ways.
I know. And, you know, I think, you know, are at a position where, you know, people can criticize, even if they don't mean it. I mean, some people do maybe mean it in a malign fashion, but, you know, a lot of people say things that they don't really know are hurtful, and they end up being. And really understanding where I was and what I believed and being able to open my heart constantly were the biggest lessons that I learned for myself and from SecMed. Can I tell you a small story?
Sure.
That's just a lovely story. I mean, I don't know that I would have associated SecMed so much with the heart if I hadn't been at the temple and been the priestess there. You know, if I had just sort of, I don't know what my path would have been with her. But at that point, you know, having a strong heart is requisite for being, I believe, for being a priestess and being able to lead. And I would I did this one shamanic journey where she came to me, and she put her big paws on my chest and broke through my flesh to my heart. And there was this hard, like a hard shell around my heart. She would break it with her paws, kneading like a cat, except for, of course, her, you know, she's got these giant claws. Break that through and toughen up my heart, and then pull her paws back, and my heart would harden over again, and she would put them back on my heart and break it over and over until my heart could be strong from within and not have to have this protective outside.
Hmm.
And that, to me, is a, just the real essence of my evolution as a priestess, is really understanding where that being able to love from the inside out.
Well, and I think that's a good story for people, you know, not only to hear, you know, sort of the evolution of a contemporary priestess, but also I think some insight on Sekhmet, because, you know, for the average person who doesn't do much digging, you know, most people only know that the story of Sekhmet where she goes on the rampage, you know.
Right.
I know pagans who were really sort of afraid of her, who don't really know her well, you know. I mean, she can certainly be a mother of tough love, but, you know, she's definitely a loving mother of healing as well as being a warrioress.
Right. Well, I mean, and, you know, her priests and probably priestesses as well were surgeons. So, I mean, healing was half of her for the
Egyptians. Absolutely.
So, and she definitely healed me in ways that I had not even known that I was wounded, and that was profound.
So let's talk a little bit about your time there. I think there were two of your early rituals. The one with Genevieve, you know, for the gift economy conference, and then Samhain. You wanted to share with listeners something particular about those two rituals? They stand out to you?
Well, yes, my very first ritual, I started just a couple weeks before Genevieve had held her conference in Las Vegas on the gift economy. And so my very first ritual was with those women. And I'd done a few other public rituals, but never at the temple, never with these women, and never, of course, with the woman who hired me, you know, there. It's sort of like, you know, I felt really on the spot. And I put a small ritual together, and women came in the temple, and we gathered around, and I looked up at the women in the circle, and who do I see but Louisa Teach, who is a world-renowned ritualist. And
no
I
pressure
thought,
there at all, huh?
I know. I thought, oh, my gosh. The very first ritual that I do is going to be witnessed by this woman, and I really had to dig deep. You know, the wonderful thing about being in the temple, of course, is that it's just such a sacred, you know, a long-held sacred space, and with my bare feet on the slate floor there, you can just really feel the earth hold you, and she did. She did hold me, but it was there were a few moments there that I thought, what am I doing? What? And maybe it was just, oh, I don't know, a couple weeks later, Teach sent me an email, and in the email she opened it with, "Dear Sister Priestess," and that was for me a feeling of being able to open a door and walk through it, and it was very profound.
Very validating.
Yes.
That's awesome.
And the second ritual that I did, where I was introduced to everyone, the congregation there at the temple, was at Samhain. And the little piece about that is that, as I said before, that I'd had my house burned not that long ago, and I really didn't have a lot of clothes. I had lost all of my ritual clothes and most of my ritual jewelry. And we just moved, and so we didn't have enough money, and I just remember just the angst of trying to find something to wear that seemed, you know, reasonably appropriate. You know, and everyone showed up in all their beautiful garb, and here I am in a sort of a dowdy jacket and a black skirt. But realizing again that it's the priestess within, not the priestess without, was another good lesson for me.
Well, and you know, when I'm sitting here thinking your house burned down, Sephmet's the sun, she's the fire goddess.
Yeah.
I'm sure you must have had some moments thinking about that, huh?
Well, yes. And then the second Samhain that I was there, the second Samhain I was there, the toaster oven in our house burned and caught fire.
Well,
and
you need some more water in your life, Anne. Is that why you moved to the West Coast?
Well, you know me, Karen. And the third Samhain that I was there, the altar cloth just caught fire in the afternoon.
You are just too fiery.
Yeah, well, and my house burned on Samhain, you know. So interesting, you know, piece. I think I'm beyond that now. I haven't had anything burn on Samhain in a while. So
yeah.
I'm feeling good about that. But
well, there's so many. I'm not sure exactly if you're going to have an answer for this, and if you don't, no pressure. It's not an easy question. There might not really be any specific answer. But what would you say if someone who knows nothing about goddess or priestesses or anything like that says to you, you know, what is a priestess? What is a priestess today in these contemporary times?
Well, a priestess has such a large span of possibilities. I mean, there are the priestesses that are completely solitary. And there are the priestesses that are out with people. And now, you know, I don't have a temple. I live here in Albuquerque, but I'm kind of a neighborhood priestess. And for me, priestessing is about service.
Mm-hmm.
It's about service in, you know, helping people. And helping people with the, I'm not a doctor, I'm not a therapist, I'm not, I don't have medical training, I don't have sight, and I'm not a counselor, and I don't really want to be anybody's counselor. But I want to be able to help people in whatever way I can. And if that means just giving somebody a quick smudge, if that means listening, which I do a lot of that, if that means a friend calls and says, I'm having in vitro, can you light a candle for me? Those are the things for me. Priestessing is about, in my mind, is about service.
Yeah, it can be so many things. I remember a group I belonged to years back, and there was always this push-pull between the priestesses who were front and center that performed the ritual versus the priestesses who were like on the business circle who made sure the bills got paid and people got invited to the rituals and, you know, the administration, sort of the sachet. Goddess, would probably like the goddess of administration, so to speak.
Yeah.
And, there were, you know, some women who didn't recognize that, you know, God, you know, priestessing as an administrator was, you know, equally valid and authentic as the people who stood in front of the, stood in front of the congregation and invoked the goddess, you know. But
yeah.
I always thought of it as, you know, they're just two different legs of a stool. You know, one needed the other. And,
right.
it all worked out. And, there's so many different roles for priestesses, hospice work, activism. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's just so much out there for the contemporary woman to do as a priestess.
Right. And it's all valuable. And even, like I said, even the priestess that is not out in the world, but is at her home, you know, chanting, lighting candles, whatever she does to bring peace into the world and to make it a better place, that is service.
Yeah, yeah. Putting that energy into the world.
That's right.
You know, maybe she does art, or maybe she writes,
right.
Or she takes care of children.
Right.
I mean, there's just so much to be done, you know. And
yeah.
we're all called.
There's a lot to be done.
Yeah, we're all called to serve in different ways. You know, one is not more valuable than another.
Right.
So what was it like there at the temple? I mean, do you have any crazy experiences from people who sort of just rolled in with no idea what in the world the place was?
Oh, yeah, there were a lot of people that just rolled in. And a lot of people that rolled in maybe for a ritual. Like there was one guy, one of my favorite stories is this guy that we would have the ritual that afterwards we kind of have a little potluck and hang out. And there was a man there that I hadn't seen before, and so I started chatting with him, and he said, "Oh, yeah, I'm out here signaling UFOs." I said, "Oh, really?" He said, "Yeah, my truck's parked out there on the BLM land, and I got a big light and a generator, and at night I signal them." And I said, "Wow, I myself, you know, I mean, not that I don't know. I'm not a big UFO kind of believer sort of person. I'm just, maybe I'm a little too literal. But I sort of looked askance at him, and I said, "Oh, really?" And he said, "They're the ones that have the answers that can help us, and I want to help this world."
Hmm.
And I thought, wow, what a great, you know?
Right, right.
It was really sweet. He was a real doll. He would,
well, you know,
he would come back every now and then.
Well, you've heard of Murray Hope and the Lions and the Crystal People? Are you familiar with that work at all?
No. No.
Well, you know, I mean, I know there are Sekhmet priestesses who believe that, you know, Sekhmet actually comes from another planet, you know, just like some think Isis actually walked the earth, you know, and was some, you know, some incredible woman of the past that, you know, is somehow, you know, turned into a deity. You know, not unlike the Cloud Atlas movie that's out right now, you know, where the Asian woman who's the activist years later, you know, people are worshiping her as a goddess. They didn't know she was a human woman. Anyway, I didn't know if you were, that's what
yeah,
I thought
no,
of when
I'm
you were.
I'm just a fire and dirt kind of girl, you know.
Nothing wrong with that. So now there were protests out there at the temple too?
Well, there were. We had, there was one time that, you know, every now and then people would show up and say things that weren't quite so nice. But there was one time I was sitting in my office in the house and I heard this strange music. And actually I thought it was music on the radio, and then I realized that it was some group down at the temple singing, and I thought, wow, I wonder who's here. So I just kind of, I lived like about a 3-minute walk from the temple, so I just kind of got out and trotted down there, and on my way down, I was starting to hear the words of the song, and the words were, "We have the keys to the gates of hell, and we shall prevail." I was like, wow,
uh-oh,
that is not a pagan song.
Right.
So I trotted down a little bit faster and came up over the ridge. And in front of the temple were this group of middle-aged people, men and women, about 6 of them, well, maybe 4 to 6, something like that. And they were dressed in torn sheets, not KKK-like, more like kind of semi-toga-ish, with and chanting, and they had a boombox with some music, and they were chanting this over and over. And as soon as they saw me, and here I am, I had done a ritual that morning, so I had on a big, long, billowing red dress, and I had on a lot of jewelry, and I definitely looked pagan priestessy, you know. Came up over the ridge and probably had some kind of a stern look on my face, and they all ran, jumped into this car, peeled out of the parking lot as I was running towards them, and the guy leaned out the window and said, "We were just looking around."
Yeah, right. That is funny.
I know.
Well,
I wrote down there, they had an Arizona license plate, and I wrote the number down just in case anything odd, you know, ever came of it, which it didn't, but I just thought, wow, that is the weirdest protest.
Well, you know, I don't know what they were there doing, but they certainly weren't very committed to it if they ran away so quickly.
I know.
Thank
literally
goodness.
Dust behind their cars. They peeled, squealed out of the parking lot. It was pretty funny.
Wow.
Oh, and they were middle-aged people. They look like they should be able to make better decisions than that.
So from what you could see, or I mean, did you think it was some sort of anti-pagan thing? Do you think that's what it was, or?
Yeah. But
interesting. Maybe. Well, you know, I've always worried about the temple out there because it is so remote that it seems like, but, you know, of course, you know, this is so stupid. You know, Sekhmet is protecting it, but, you know, it's ripe for vandalism or something, you know, because
yeah.
there would be nobody to see anything happen. And I think there's something to be said for the fact that, you know, it's flourished out there, you know, and nobody's gotten crazy or done anything stupid.
Well, it has. It's a very sweetly protected place. I mean, things do, you know, I had to come to terms with the fact that things sometimes would go missing in the temple, but
mm-hmm.
things would also show up in the temple all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So who am I to say, you know, what shouldn't be right there? And Ben, my husband, he and I slept outside on a platform, and so we would actually be able to hear at night if anyone came up. And Ben, my husband is, he's probably about 5'7", about 150 pounds. He's not a big guy. But there was one night somebody came up to the temple, and so he, you know, went down and turned his flashlight on and, you know, asked who they were, just scared to death these three huge Marines.
Marines?
Well, maybe not Marines, Army,
there's,
you know, they were definitely Air Force or Marine, some sort of Army guy. And they just were like, it was pretty funny, he said, they just like squealed and ran.
I wonder if they were pagan or if they were just curious.
I don't know. I think they were just curious. I think they, you know, we're right across the street from an Air Force base.
Right.
So
let's go check out this place.
That's right. I think they were just curious about it, and Ben, you know, managed to scare off, you know, 400 pounds of masculine flesh there.
Well, you know, who knows how he looked to them? You know, he may have looked, you know, totally different than his real human form. You never know. So, well, you know, why don't you give a brief description of the temple, you know, for those who haven't had the pleasure of seeing it.
Well, it's really beautiful, and it's a very simple structure, and there is just such incredible beauty in its simplicity. So it is it's about an hour north of Las Vegas. It's not that far off Highway 95, so you can still sort of hear the highway from the temple, which is kind of nice that it's not too long of a drive off the highway. It's easy to get to. It's a straw bale structure, and it's painted cream, and it's got four sides and doors that actually open to the cross. They don't actually open to the direction. The walls are actually in the north, south, east, west directions, and the doors are in the cross quarters. And there's a statue of Sekhmet against the south wall. A statue inside, a statue of Madre del Mundo, which is a beautiful statue of an Aboriginal woman holding the earth in her lap, is on the north wall. And then there are other, La Virgen de Guadalupe is on the west wall. And there are other different goddesses sort of scattered about, and in the center is a fire pit. And so the doors are open. There's no coverings on the doors. And the ceiling is, I mean, it's an open-air temple, so there's a copper tubing dome on the top that's actually in the shape of a seven-petal lotus. So if you're laying in the temple and looking up, you see this. It's almost a yantra, just beautiful inner crossings of the copper pipes up there, copper tubing. So doing ritual in this place, I guess that's why I say I'm a dirt and fire kind of priestess. I mean, there's nothing, you are in with the wind, you're in with the rain, you're in with the cold, you're in with the hot, you're there with the dust, you're there with the mice, with the snakes, with the other little critters that run around, you're out there with the plants, your feet are on the stone, there's slate stones on the floor of the temple, and one of my favorite things to do is to go and stand on those stones after the sun has warmed them. It's just, and lay on them, and you can, you know, you're just in the earth's embrace there. Mm. It's really spectacular. Doing ritual outside like that is spectacular.
Do you miss it?
Oh, of course. I'm back a few times a year, so.
Yeah.
Well, and now that I'm in Albuquerque, I'm really only just at like a 9-hour drive.
So I drive up
and spend a week.
So how did you know it was time to move on?
Well, I always felt when I was there that, I always felt that I wouldn't be there forever. And I that was sort of one of the lessons I learned from having my house burn was that sometimes if you're in somebody's place, they can't be in that place. And I can't be in that next place, you know. And so there's a real idea that I have about not blocking the way for someone else.
Mm-hmm.
And, sorry about that, Karen. I did divination every 6 months to see when it would show up that my time was up. And, sorry, at one time it just happened. So that was kind
of
it.
Well, that's putting a lot of faith in. What was it, a tarot reading or?
That happened to be with a pendulum.
Okay.
But yes, I did tarot readings. I did. I pretty much did just about every divination.
And you kept getting the same answer.
Yeah. Well, I got no, don't leave for a while. And then when that winter solstice before I left, I got, yes, it's time.
Wow. So now your personal initiation, which is, I'm sure, probably at the heart of your memoir, what did you want to share with listeners about that?
I think there's... we live in times that initiation doesn't happen the way it would have happened before with a long lineage of priestesses. And so it takes a lot of internal courage to go through self-initiation, which I found, because it really is saying that I believe this is who I am. This hasn't been conferred on me, but I believe that this is, that I am a priestess.
So you're saying that takes a lot more courage than have someone dub you a priestess.
It did for me.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I have to stand up and say, and now I don't even have a temple I'm associated with. So I still...
Right. Well,
it takes a lot of personal courage, I think,
The reality is, I talked about some of this in my book, just sort of the politics out there in the women's community. Then there's the other, there can be the other part of it where some people believe they're priestesses and look down their nose at other people and judge them not to be, So I'm not sure what's harder to go through, someone telling you you're not in their eyes, or having to figure it out for yourself and claim it and embrace it as your authentic self,
Well, but I've had lots of people tell me that I'm either not a good priestess or not a worthy priestess at the temple or afterwards, so that happens too. People are just people. I mean, they've got their stuff, and people can feel that way about me. I got accused of being a fluffy bunny, which just kind of cracks me up.
Me
or just too. Because I'm nice.
Me too. We should join it. We should make a club.
I know. So
someone
I don't really see myself that way. But so people are going to have say what they're going to say, and they're going to have the opinions that they have, and there's not much to be done. But one of the things that I did for my initiation that was I really felt like I had to get out of my mindset of being a college administrator. I had done that for so many years that I just needed to break from that completely and really give myself over you know, to really living a spiritual life on all levels.
So you're sort of making the shift from the left brain more to the right brain.
Maybe, yeah. Even though there's a lot of left brain stuff having to do with running a temple too, but being able to open the right brain, I suppose. And I shaved my head. Actually, I had Ben shave my head. My husband Ben shaved my head while a friend of mine, Sylvia Brellier, another priestess, did a chant for Sekhmet and a chant for China Masta, who's a Hindu goddess that I have a devotion to. So it was really, it was really profound to start over again, to feel that way, feel that I was starting with a lot less baggage. I consider doing it again every now and then because it was just, it was so freeing to let go of everything and to let go of everything that had made me who I was before so that I could be somebody different.
It's courageous.
It was necessary. Let me tell you, it was necessary. I mean, courageous too, but I don't think I could have done it without letting
go.
Yeah,
I mean, it's this interesting... I think it's this interesting mix of being courageous and feeling liberated and being, maybe it's kind of a scary thing to do too. It's big stuff.
Yeah, I have long brown curly hair and I'd had a lot of feeling about my hair as far as my identity and my sexuality, my femininity, and my strength, you know, this big mane of hair is kind of a strong thing. And it was something to lose all that. It was great. It was really good. I felt like I could really get out of myself and be more than I was. So.
Well, I actually look forward to reading your memoir, Anne. I always like to read what life is like for another priestess. Just to sort of, have the opportunity to glimpse behind the veil. and see what other, how other people are, walking that ancient path, So tell us, Desert Priestess is now on audiobook.
Right. It's available in paperback or Kindle from, all the usual places.
Okay.
And it's also available as a download from CD Baby. So... an audio download. I don't have it pressed into CDs, but I do have it available as a download. So,
okay.
And Abby Spinner McBride, as you well know her well, and she read the book and produced it. So,
she did
an amazing job.
Well, I'm going to be playing her Sekhmet, before the end of the show tonight. As we close out or something, I feel like I can't not honor my other mama there. And Heart of the Sun, I want to make sure people know about that too, because and tell me if I'm wrong, Anne, but I think Heart of the Sun is probably the best resource for someone who wants to know about Sekhmet, because there's really sort of a dearth of information out there. It's just a little bit scattered here and there, but if you get Heart of the Sun, you sort of have all of that in one place, don't you?
You do. And there's a section of Heart of the Sun. It's an anthology. It has 35 contributors. So you get lots of different views of Sekhmet, from academic and personal, as well as poetry and ritual.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the most beautiful things, I think, is really understanding goddesses from a lot of perspectives and then finding one's own within that. And Abby also produced an audio CD for Heart of the Sun, and that we have available from Goddess Inc. in CDs, or we have it as a download.
Okay. So tell listeners about Goddess Inc. Mention the websites, please, so they can go look at all of this for themselves and
yeah.
you know, maybe buy some of these things for holiday gifts.
Yeah, we also have coffee mugs. But Goddess Inc. is a publishing independent publishing company that I own with Candace Camp, who lives in Las Vegas, and also, I have been a priestess at the temple. It's where we met. And our website is www.goddess-inc.com. So go look. We have we have the anthology of writings about Sekhmet. We have my memoir, Desert Priestess. We carry some other books from some sister publishers. And then I know that you and probably many of our listeners have heard that Patricia Monahan has passed away, which is just heartbreaking. But the right, she and I have been working for the last year on an anthology of writings on Bridget, and actually I just sent it today to the book designer, and so that will be coming out in February. So that will be
her last book.
She will live on, which is wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah, and I'm glad you brought that up. Actually, I interviewed her here on the show, and if folks would like to, hear her talk about her work, they can actually find it in the archives. And if they have any trouble finding it, just email me, and I'll, you know, point you in the right direction, because I know the archives are pretty lengthy over the last couple of years, but it's actually pretty easy to find. Well, Anne, thank you so much for being out there with your pink-handled machete, blazing a new trail for priestesses and, showing women another way to be.
Oh, thanks, Karen. Thanks for having me on the show. It's always nice to chat with you.
Well, I appreciate it. Thank you so much. And, best of luck with all your projects. And,
okay.
Don't forget to make sure you have more water.
I'll work on that, Karen.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much.
Okay. Bye.
Good night. Well, we are crossing the threshold into the second part of the show. And I have a few quick housekeeping bits before we get to our second guest, Lorelei, who I see is there on the switchboard. I'm just going to ask her to be patient just for a quick little minute here because I have something to share. I'm going to be leading a tour to Turkey in the spring. It's going to be at the end of May and the beginning of June. And it's going to be an incredible journey. I'm actually going to be taking it with the scholar James Rietveld. He's co-leading with me. He's probably the foremost authority on the goddess Artemis in the United States. The details are finally up on my website, so I encourage you to go there and find our itinerary, all the wonderful places we're going to visit. I mean, there are so many goddess sites in Turkey, it's hard not to really just stumble over them, whether we're talking about Isis or Aphrodite, Artemis, Kubaba, Kabeli, Mary. It's really a glorious destination, whether you're going there for spirituality or scholarship or to experience other cultures and other food. We're going to be watching whirling dervish performances and doing Turkish baths. Please, if it sounds like something that you might want to do, if you're hearing that call, please consider coming with us. This is going to be a tour for both men and women, again, in the end of May and the beginning of June. Blood of her veins, the rivers, voice of her breath, the wind, fire of her will, those erupting volcanoes, green of her hair, that's the rolling grass hills, strength of her spine. Well, those are the mountain's tall backs. Persephone, moon maiden, whose returning steps grant springtime once more. Those are some of the opening words from the DVD, Dancing with Gaia. Dancing with Gaia is a wonderful film about the goddess, sacred sexuality, and about connecting to the earth and ways to do that. It gives you tools to connect in a very real way to the landscape and spirit of the earth around you. It's also visually stunning. And the DVD comes packaged with a useful booklet that explains all of this if you're new to goddess spirituality or earth-based religion. And it's only $20, and you can get it from dancingwithgaia.com. And as I said before to Anne about her books and the audio tapes and everything, the holidays are upon us, and we're always looking for something for our like-minded friends that's beautiful and meaningful. And I can recommend all of this stuff. I've seen Dancing with Gaia. It is really quite lovely. You might really want to consider it. You know, go to the website, dancingwithgaia.com, and take a look. Also, I want to keep thanking you for your listener loyalty. I really can never thank you enough. The stats every week are through the roof and growing like a plant on Miracle Grow or something. So thank you so much for keeping, keeping with me and sending me ideas for guests and feedback on the show. And I love you too. Also, remember the two F's. Click the follow button so you get news of who's on the show each week without having to rely on getting a reminder email from me. And please, I invite you to click on the friend button too and become a friend of the show. Become a part of the international Voices of the Sacred Feminine Family. And remember, some people get confused. They think, well, Karen, I can't listen to you at 6 or 7 o'clock Pacific time. Well, you know, you don't have to. You can catch the show anytime from the archives at your convenience. In fact, I hear most of you download and listen, via iTunes. Maybe you're running or you're washing clothes or you're sitting in the airport waiting for a flight. All of those different things. You can take me with you, and I can help you pass the time, and you can enjoy my wonderful guests. So, without further delay, let me say hello to Lorelei. Hi, Lorelei.
Hi, Karen.
Well, I'm so glad you're back with me tonight. We had such a fun conversation last time we started talking about Aphrodite. We realized we had so much more to say.
Absolutely. I think she's my favorite topic. I could talk about her for days on end.
Well, I can understand that. And, you know, I opened the show tonight and paid tribute to her with Diva Haley's tribute to Aphrodite on her Sacred Alchemy CD. So I just wanted you to know that in case you didn't hear the opening of the show. But let me just tell listeners a little bit about you first, Lorelei, before we get going, just in case they didn't hear us the first time we sort of did part one. So listeners, Lorelei, she's been a devotee and priestess of Aphrodite for a little over 13 years, and she's the author of four books devoted to Aphrodite's worship, including Cult of Aphrodite, a compilation of well-researched rituals and religious festivals in her honor. Then there's Crown of Violets, that's a book of devotional poetry. There's Temple of Love, a historical novel depicting the poetess Sappho as an Aphrodite priestess, and Aphrodite's Priestess, a resource book for those who would serve the goddess of love. And on rare occasions, she has acted as both a mantis, and I'd never get that word right. Tell me again. Herodule. I know I'm not. Herodule.
Herodule.
Herodule. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Herodule. I'm going to have to write that out phonetically and say it a dozen times so I remember. So, well, welcome back. What have you been up to since we had you on the show a couple months ago?
Oh, I've primarily been homeschooling my daughter and working as a psychic reader, actually, at a store called Inner Path in Greenwood, very close to where I live.
Okay.
Here in Indiana.
Now, all of your books, Cult of Aphrodite, Crown of Violets, Aphrodite's Priestess, are those still available if listeners, you know, we're talking about gifts for the holidays, if someone wanted to, you know, delve into one of those, do they get them from your website or Amazon or where?
They're available both from our website, the AsteriaBooks.com website, which is the publishing company that I own with my partner, Natalie. And they're also available from Amazon, every one of them.
Okay. All right. Well,
they're easy to find.
Okay. Okay, cool. And, you know, we were just, I was talking to Ann Key. I don't know if you heard our interview or maybe you know of her. She spent 3 or 4 years as the priestess of the Sekhmet Temple in Nevada. So our topic tonight, you know, has really sort of lent itself to contemporary priestessing. And, you know, I think where we wanted to, you know, sort of reconnect, you know, sort of have some continuity from the last show is we wanted to talk about Aphrodisian initiation and being a priest or a priestess of Aphrodite, what that looks like in the contemporary world. And where would you like to start, Lorelei? What makes the most sense to you?
Well, I think maybe to touch back to some of the things that we were saying in regards to Aphrodite's role as the as a guider or as a representative of the space between,
mm-hmm.
this idea of liminality that we had touched on or that we had talked quite a lot about, actually. Because liminality, initiation is inherently a liminal time. It's a liminal space. It's a place between one aspect of your life or one entire concept of your life, and the close of that really before it becomes something new.
Yeah, I like to think of it as a threshold. That's a nice visual for me to hold on to. You know, you're kind of in a place between two places.
Yes, absolutely, and that's this idea of being in the place between two places is something that Aphrodite is symbolic of throughout her stories. She's associated very much with islands, which are livable land, you know, but out in the midst of water, so you're not quite in one place and not quite in the other. She's associated with water birds, which have the gift of flight and are associated with the air, with the heavens, but then they're very much associated with the water. They swim and catch most of their food from the water's depths. So she's also associated with the morning and the evening star, the planet Venus, very heavily associated with that, obviously, which we see there in at dawn and at dusk. She's associated with foam. Her name, one of the interpretations of her name is foam-born, which again is like water and air, not quite water and not quite air.
Yeah, again, that constantly that in-between. You know, I hadn't thought
right.
about the idea of the islands, but that's really very interesting. And so I'm thinking, it makes me think of Cyprus. You know,
yes.
where she, one of her, you know, one of her main temple places, you know, on that island, obviously.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Cyprus and Cytheria or Cytheria, Cythera, which is another place that claims credit to being her birthplace. Crete is very much associated with her worship. You know, there are several places that are island temples or island homes that were huge centers of her worship in the ancient world.
I wonder
Delos.
Do you know if she had a temple in Delos?
She didn't specifically, but one of the ancient faces of goddess that really contributed to the Greeks' concept of Aphrodite was there at Delos. There's a dove temple there, or a dove shrine or sanctuary. I don't know if I'm quite describing it correctly, but there's a huge cache of dove goddess imagery. And Aphrodite herself is called the dove in many places throughout literature, and her priestesses are very, very often called doves, sometimes specifically red doves.
Hmm. Well, that's interesting. Why red? Because of passion or...
Yes, yeah, that's my belief specifically, is that it has to do with the passion, with those with that aspect of
Or I'm wondering if maybe even blood, too, you know, because blood is life, and she's sort of one of these from womb to tomb goddesses, even though some people mistaken her, you know, as just sort of the goddess of love and beauty. You know, they don't really know the full extent of her, you know, her myth, her mythology.
Right.
You know?
Exactly. And I would think if of blood, too, also it would be very much related to the blood of the maidenhead, the virgin blood, because that is another time of crossing over. That's very much an initiatory process in itself.
Yeah.
And she's one of the models of initiation that she gives us is in regards to Adonis and what I like to call the sharing of the pomegranate. Which is the pomegranate is very much associated with crossing that threshold from girlhood into womanhood, as we see in the myth of Persephone.
Okay.
But on the island of Cyprus, which was, you know, Aphrodite's one of the first cult centers of Aphrodite in Greece, the pomegranate, not the apple, was the symbol of Aphrodite. It was the fruit of Aphrodite, and there's a huge pomegranate tree there that's specifically associated with her.
Yeah, I think there's a statue of her in the Louvre where she's holding an apple, but it's not just the apple, it's the pomegranate too, that's her fruit.
Yes.
You know, your book that you talk about the poetess Sappho as an Aphrodite priestess, do we know? I mean, were you taking creative license there as all, you know, writers do, or do we have some indication that maybe Sappho was an Aphrodite priestess?
I was definitely taking some creative license. We actually know very few facts about Sappho's life. We have her work primarily to inform us and work of other poets, you know, and sort of politicians of the time period who mentioned her and what she did. But so much of her poetry is about love, is about loving relationships. And a lot of it actually is specifically dedicated to Aphrodite herself. There are odes or invocations of Aphrodite. There are several where she's pleading for Aphrodite's help or giving thanks for the help that Aphrodite's already given. So when I read her work, I very much see Aphrodite's touch on it.
So it's not
and that was
logic.
Where my inspiration was.
It would make sense. You know, talking about that that space in between, that I think you call it the liminality. I'm wondering about someone who, say, is transgendered or transsexual or maybe even bisexual. Would that be another aspect, maybe that would be a realm that Aphrodite sort of rules over, so to speak?
Absolutely. In fact, even in the ancient world, the classical world, there were transgender priestesses of Aphrodite, men who had forsaken their lives as men and served as women within the temple. And I'm sure that some of that, you know, we don't have, you know, particularly clear records on exactly what everybody's function was within temples devoted almost wholly to sexuality. But it stands to reason with the kind of culture that ancient and classical Greece was, that there would have been a great deal of that sort of bisexuality, transgender crossover there, especially in terms of Aphrodite's temple, because she is so much associated with the space between.
Okay. Well, now, getting back to the pomegranate, that may be a good segue to talk about Adonis and the sharing of the pomegranate. What's the symbolism there? What do we have to know about that to help us understand Aphrodite and what she's about to those of us who, you know, might be feeling called to be her priestess?
Okay, well, specifically because it's, you know, I call it the sharing of the pomegranate because both Persephone and Aphrodite are very much attached to this to the symbol. Persephone widely known that the pomegranate's her fruit. With Aphrodite, we also have the same kind of symbolism going on here that the juice and seeds of the pomegranate sort of resemble the blood of womanhood, marking this transition. And it's also important to remember that in her earlier guises, Aphrodite's earlier guises, in the Middle East and the Fertile Crescent, she was Inanna, she was Ishtar, whose sister was Ereshkigal, the queen of the underworld, and Aphrodite herself makes a journey into the underworld to comfort her sister and goes through what we can very much see as an initiation process. For the Greeks, they really parsed out some of these details, and they made it almost difficult to find the connection between Persephone and Aphrodite, but it's definitely there. It's there in the symbol of the pomegranate. It's there in the fact that they share Adonis, the beautiful young man, whose name, the name Adonis just means Lord. But Adonis is associated with Cyprus in the same way that Aphrodite is. He was the son of the king who established Aphrodite's worship there. And he was beautiful. We all know this about his legend, about his myth, that he was this wonderful young man. And Persephone and Aphrodite were given Adonis's care into their keeping. The year was split into thirds for Adonis. He could spend a third of it with Persephone, a third of it with Aphrodite, and then a third of it wherever he wanted, but he chose to spend his third with Aphrodite as well. Mm-hmm. Until his death, he was killed quite intentionally. He was sacrificed. The myth doesn't say that he was sacrificed necessarily, but he was killed in a jealous rage. And Aphrodite is so forlorn over the loss of him that she establishes funerary rites that, as a part of women's religion all over Greece, that would honor the passing of Adonis every year. Every year they would mourn his death, and the women planted these little
seedlings,
lettuce.
Something.
Yes, yeah, very quick growing leaves, very quick growing plants like lettuce and fennel, which would sprout up very quickly and then die very quickly, which was said to be symbolic then of Adonis's life. And they would wail and mourn and bury the beloved boy. Now, an interesting thing that I've just learned is that it was not until Imperial Rome that anybody actually mentioned, because this was a sort of a mystery cult, nobody actually wrote down or mentioned that the women were then consoled by a revived Adonis, by a resurrected Adonis.
Huh.
So Adonis is very much, he's the lover, you know, he's the sacred lover, which mirrors Aphrodite's role as that, the paramour, and he's also the dying and resurrecting god. And that provides for us then a model of initiation for the individual or a model of male initiation potentially through Aphrodite.
So let's talk about initiation a little bit. I think it's mm-hmm. a word that maybe is a little bit confusing to the contemporary mind. You know, how would you describe what an initiation is to say a newbie, for instance? Would you say it's leaving behind one life for another? It's some sort of a transition. It's stepping over the threshold into a new life. Or is there more to it than that? Does there have to be suffering and challenge involved, like Inanna going down to the underworld? Or speak to that a little bit, so that, people, contemporary women, have an idea of, what initiation really is, for a priestess today.
Right. Well, all of the things that you said, actually, I think count, the death of one life and the rebirth of a new life, leaving one mode of operating and being and seeing the world really behind in favor of this new thing. It really is a death and rebirth process. There's a point certainly in the initiations that I've undergone and in those that I've read about that you have to sort of surrender control. You have to you know, you have to succumb to the process. You have to walk out of one world. Have a moment of stillness, you know, a time of stillness, and then very much walk into the other world. And both of those things have to be your choice, I think. I don't know that there has to be pain and suffering with initiation, but I think there very often is. Birth is frightening and painful. Death is, you know, it's not always painful, but it's it can be very frightening. You know,
sure.
You don't really know what that new world's going to entail.
Well, you know,
that new life's going to be like.
I'm thinking about when someone pledges for a sorority, you know, they go through that initiation phase, and I can see where that's, you know, they're leaving behind, you know, childish things, and now they're going to be part of this sorority house. You know, they go through that hazing period of challenges. It's interesting. I mean, I don't know the history of sororities or initiations into clubs, but it makes me wonder if it's not sort of a throwback to, you know, some of this ancient mythology.
You know, I think you're right. I think it absolutely is. My former high priestess, my initiator, used to talk about two different kinds of initiation. There was little I initiation and there was big I initiation.
Mm-hmm.
Little I initiation happened at the hands of other people, where we try to create a circumstance or a set of circumstances that's going to walk a person through this process, or at least show them the path so that they can walk themselves. And we do in those little I initiation processes, these ones that we go through at the hands of other people. I think there's an inherent tendency to make it difficult, to make it challenging. There's the sense that we're going to have to prove that this is something we really want, that we're really capable, that we're not afraid, and that even if we are afraid, we're willing to face that fear in the name of the thing that we want to become.
Well, and it's
now,
almost a challenge to see if you're really committed, you know.
Right. Exactly so.
Yeah.
There's a testing to see if you're worthy. And I think that happens even within the initiations that we have at the hands of the gods. You know, I don't think that they put us through anything that we're not capable of handling, but we have to come to that ourselves too, because they're certainly going to test us on every level to make
sure.
Yeah,
it's sort of like their tough love initiation, you know, almost like running a gauntlet or something, you know, a test, you know, that saying, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger kind of a thing.
Right.
I don't mean to make it sound so scary, but sometimes, you know, sometimes challenges in life do sort of leave us unbalanced a little bit, you know, till we can find our way.
That's absolutely right. And it's, if you think of it in terms of the hero's journey described by Joseph Campbell, you know, you go through this road of trials, there are guardians at the thresholds, and you spend this time in the belly of the whale really, you know, struggling with these deep, dark, hard concepts before you break through and have this return journey where you've assimilated all of this and you're embarking on that new life.
And you come back with some wisdom, hopefully, maybe.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, you come out wiser and stronger than you were before.
So now psyche and the initiation of the soul, does that sort of play into this, you know, what we're talking about, this sort of transformation we go through?
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. In fact, when you were saying that there's that tough love, that road of challenges, I thought, that's psyche. You know, that's the story of psyche. And again, this is somebody that Aphrodite and Persephone share in the mythology. And here, the goddess of love and life and the goddess of death and the underworld conspire in testing really the human soul, because that's what the word psyche means. Psyche means soul in Greek. And they're testing it to see if the human soul is worthy of a place among the gods, I think. Psyche's challenged by Aphrodite to complete several tasks that are all difficult and could seem impossible. But Psyche stands up to the tasks and accomplishes them. And the last one is an underworld journey to retrieve a treasure that Aphrodite has stored with Persephone in the underworld. So she sends her down to face death, to see if she's, to see if she, the story is translated so many times, and it's given so many times in such a way that Aphrodite always looks like a terrible tormentor of Psyche. But it's absolutely my belief, having read the mythologies, that she's not, that she's making sure she's fit, that she's making sure Psyche as the soul, that Psyche is fit for her son.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's what Psyche's goal is to be reunited with, to be reunited with Eros, Aphrodite's son.
So just
in terms of the story, this is a mother-in-law making sure that the daughter-in-law is worthy of her little boy.
Well, and as I'm hearing you talk about this too, I'm thinking about this as early metaphors, maybe for life's challenges, and then maybe the reward of heaven. Or am I putting too much of a Christian spin on this? You think?
No, you're not. You're not at all, because that's exactly what Psyche, what the soul, is given for her reward. She's being tested, and then is ultimately deemed fit for divinity, for a place among the gods. And if you put that in terms of, you know, of the sort of allegory that's happening here, the human soul proved itself worthy, not just Psyche as an individual who achieved heaven, but the human soul proved itself worthy for a place among the gods to become godlike. And also we have the soul being wed to love, because the name Eros, the word Eros, means love. So there's this divine union of the human spirit and love, which is the union that's blessed by Aphrodite.
So rather than really looking at them as they're really the personifications of love and the soul, you know, so again, we go back to the Greeks use the gods to sort of mirror concepts rather than real people.
Right. And they, and sometimes they throw in some people in there, you know, some real people, some historical people. But really, I think one of the things that's sort of amazing about the way that it's done is that you really have to dig to get to it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, there's an entertaining story on the surface, but it has this feel of a parable, you know, where there's so much more that lies beneath if you just work for it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I've said, you know, really often to people who, you know, I've had people come up to me and say, oh, you know, paganism, goddess spirituality, whatever label you want to put on it, it's just too shallow. It's these wheel of the year rituals, and you know, there's nothing else there. But there really is a lot there if you're just willing to, you know, to dig a little, you know, to see the stories, you know, the morality plays, the analogies that sort of give you, you know, guideposts to live by. I mean, and really, this is like, Christianity just sort of stole some of these ideas once again, you know, as opposed to, them coming up with the idea of life after death and redemption and rebirth and all of that stuff. You know, I always go back to, you know, Christians need to, they need to do a little bit more reading and see how much they really owe paganism.
Well, truly, yes. And not necessarily just out of that sense of owing, but I don't know, maybe there's the idea that these things are just sort of universal inherent lessons that we're all going to struggle with and grapple with and find ways to understand. And I think one of the things that happens with a lot of folks who identify with the big monotheistic religions is that they don't realize that they weren't the first to look at them, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think even if, however things develop, I think that ideas of death and love and the passage of time and our connections with each other, our relationships with each other, I think these are all things that we're going to look at. If these myths didn't already exist, we'd probably be finding a way to make them exist. And really, we do. We as new literature is created, it's the same concepts that are getting told again and again.
Yeah, and I think the important part of this universality is it's common ground if we really wanted to find it, you know, instead of instead of the divisiveness, maybe.
Right. There's more that makes us the same.
Yeah. Then we're different. You know.
Then we're different. Yeah.
Yeah. Well. Let's talk. I know my listeners love to hear about, you know, being a priestess, whether we're talking about ancient times or contemporary times. Talk a little bit about that, Lorelei. What do you think it was? You know, what was it like to be a priestess of Aphrodite in ancient times?
Well, there would be a couple of different. There'd be several different roles because priestesses in ancient and classical Greek, ancient and classical Greece, fulfilled a lot of different roles. You didn't necessarily have the Greeks weren't necessarily very big on having dedicated priests and priestesses that gave their life over to the temple and that stayed there and did only that work for the rest of their life. For the most part. Most priestly roles were filled by a person for a given ritual or for a period of time, a year or several years, and then they resumed their life back among the world. But there are some notable exceptions, and Aphrodite's priestesses, the ones that served in the temple, were certainly among those very notable exceptions. Very often, if you were a priestess of Aphrodite, that was not a choice you came to on your own, which is interesting and a little strange and off-putting to me, actually, from this modern perspective. You were probably the, you know, second or third or further along the line daughter of a man, you know, of a father who couldn't afford to give you a dowry, couldn't afford to get you properly married, so he would give you as a gift to the temple. Or you were a slave who was given by your owner as a gift to the temple in thanks of something that Aphrodite had done in their lives. So
you didn't start off. I mean, this wasn't this wasn't a glorious thing, really. It it wasn't like it was something only the rich women did, or you could enter the temple if you had a lot of money or something. That wasn't really
right.
Okay.
It was and it wasn't. In its very earliest conceptions, where the goddess of love was worshipped in very similar temples in the Middle East, there were parts of the Fertile Crescent where every woman served her time in the temple. Every woman waited, and she was not allowed to get married until she had welcomed the stranger in the temple, until she had had, you know, sexual intercourse with a man whom she did not know in service of the great goddess of love. There were other times in other places, again, throughout that area, throughout Sumer, throughout Phoenicia, and et cetera, where being a temple prostitute or even a tavern prostitute was considered a sacred thing. You were an emissary of the goddess. But the Greeks, by the time this concept came to Greece, the connotations had shifted a little bit. There's a lot of divorcing of Aphrodite from, as a goddess of love, from some of the things that made her really powerful and really universal in her Middle Eastern earlier counterparts. You know, she's dissociated with war, except that war is her lover. She's dissociated with death. You know, Persephone and Aphrodite are not described as sisters who share this bond between love and death. They're two different things, and you have to really sort of suss out the fact that there is a connection between them. They share Adonis, they share Psyche, they share, you know, this very potent symbol of the pomegranate. But it's easy to overlook that if you're not specifically searching for their connection.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Prostitutes were considered very, very a very fringe element of classical society, and even prior to that, they were still considered emissaries of the goddess. They were still considered, they were under her protection. One of Aphrodite's names is Aphrodite Porne, which means Aphrodite of sex or Aphrodite of prostitutes.
So now, are we talking, if I'm confusing, you know, contemporary mores, tell me, but are we talking about two different levels of prostitute, the brothel prostitute versus the temple prostitute?
They were both considered under her under her aegis, as it were, to borrow a different term. But they were both considered under her protection. They were both both types, but certainly a brothel prostitute or a street prostitute, and they certainly had those too, were not considered to be of a high stature. It was better to be a temple prostitute in terms of the way the society viewed you.
So now, do you think all of the Aphrodite priestesses, had this element of sacred sexuality as part of what they did, or maybe that was, some did and some didn't?
I think some did and some didn't. I don't think that they all did. I think that there are things that have to happen to help a temple run, to allow people in to worship, that are not sexual. And there are so many aspects of Aphrodite that deal with love on a broader scale than simply the sexuality. And the sexuality is a very potent way to approach her. It's a very potent concept for us generally, and it's one that's filled with conflict for us. Certainly as modern people, we have a lot of issues with our sexuality.
But I think that's an important point that, that maybe needs to be punctuated. There were all different kinds of love, and those were all sort of under her umbrella.
Yes, absolutely. Because in the same way that a prostitute would come at the end of her career and leave perfume and makeup and a mirror at Aphrodite's temple, and these were all artifacts that there are historical records to show, so would a bride come before her wedding and leave offerings at the temple. Because to have Aphrodite's blessing on your marriage meant not only that you had, a fruitful marriage that produced children, which was, of course, very important, but that you had passion within your marriage, which was something that did not frequently exist.
Right. Well, and maybe, and I'm guessing here, but maybe there was also, love for humanity, love for, love for your family and siblings. I mean, were there such things as that too?
Yes, absolutely. And again, we get lots of clues about that in the names that Aphrodite is given and these epithets that describe her. Aphrodite Pandemos was, of all the people, is what Pandemos means, of everybody. And there was a statue of Aphrodite in the Agora, in the marketplace in Athens. And she was invoked. She was asked for her help so that people spoke civilly to each other and carried a love of their neighbor and of their community, of their polis, as they discussed these great civic concepts and had debates.
Yeah, and you're reminding me, I think we talked about this last time, but it seems a perfect time to throw it in. Politicians really revered her because they felt like part of her was communication and influence, and they needed that, and she
absolutely.
Those were the energy, those were her gifts as well.
Yes, absolutely. And
attraction.
The stories of
yes,
absolutely. That charm, having this charm, this
charisma.
And there are so many stories of positive family relationships with Aphrodite, and there are stories of her and, so many stories of her and her girlfriends, playing and dancing and really enjoying this sort of sisterhood. She was always with a group of women, she was with the Seasons and the Graces and the, and all these nymphs laughing and playing and dancing and this sort of great bond of
a
female sorority, is there, is present.
So what about Aphrodite's current priestesses? Do they exist? Are they just in, neo-paganism or goddess spirituality? You're obviously one. How extensive are Aphrodite priestesses today? Is there any way to know?
I don't know for sure that there's any great way to know, but I can tell you that there are plenty of us. and more and more as you know, as we're starting to talk about these concepts regarding Aphrodite, as more material is published and people are coming together, I'm part of a wonderful couple of communities, actually, that worship Aphrodite, that honor Aphrodite. And I know that it's pretty widespread across America, and I've got good friends within this movement in, you know, in the UK, in Brazil. There's a huge, or I would describe it as huge, there seem to be lots and lots of people in Brazil who are very drawn to working with Aphrodite, and who really serve, I think, as priests and priestesses in their own right.
Well, and I think they're
doing very different things. You know, some of us are very administrative, as you said when you were talking with Anne. One of the things that I joke laughingly about quite a lot right now is that I see myself not so much as a sacred whore, but as a sacred organizer. I'm an organizer.
I help facilitate. Well, you know, I'm trying to remember the fella's name. I interviewed him, maybe it was last December. I think it might have been. He's actually a guy in he's either in Greece or Turkey. I want to say maybe he's on Cyprus. And he's trying to get funds together to finish an Aphrodite film. And I know I saw some clips of, you know, there are most definitely contemporary priestesses of Aphrodite in the Mediterranean area. I mean, you know, people are out there on the beach doing ritual to her. I don't think it's too much of a stretch to say there's a resurgence.
Right. No, I completely agree. There's definitely a resurgence in her worship and in many of the old gods. I mean, it's and goddesses, this is something that we see quite a lot.
So now tell me about Venus and Rome. Were they a carbon copy, more or less, with just different names in different countries? I mean, were they more or less the same goddess?
They are and they aren't. The Romans, the Romans had their own worldview. They had their own way of looking at things. There were aspects of their culture that were just very significantly different than Greece. And so in the same way that the Greeks took concepts from Astarte and Inanna and Ishtar and made them into their new idea of the goddess of love. So I think did the Romans. For the Roman culture, Aphrodite is very much the great mother. You know, she's the mother of Aeneas, whose travels we hear about, whose journeys we hear about in the Aeneid. And he is the founder of Rome. She's every year the city of Venice it's named after Venus, and it has this wedding rite to remarry itself with the sea and with the goddess specifically.
I didn't know that. I live in Venice Beach, and so I live in the city of Venus.
Yes. Yeah.
Oh,
very
wow.
Much. Now, and of course the Italian city of Venice has this huge association with the water and with seafaring, and they were a great naval force, and the goddess of the ocean and the sky was sort of necessary, I think, for her to be on their side.
Now, you know,
and, yeah, Venice Beach.
When you were on before, I know we were talking about that that conference I went to at the Getty, and I don't remember if I asked you this or not, but I remember one of the scholars really blew me away because she said she believed that a fusion of Aphrodite and Isis happened in the Mediterranean, and a new goddess was basically created, and that this went beyond just the usual syncretism that you see now and again, you know, that an actual new goddess was created by the people. And of course you can get into do we create God or does God create us? But have you run across anything like that?
I have run across that idea, actually. But I don't have a lot of information on it necessarily, but I have seen that proposed as an idea, and it makes sense to me. I mean, Aphrodite, the goddess of love as she shows up in Greece, was different than she was in the Middle East. She's not exactly the same. There are other influences there. There's the Dove Goddess of, and you know when I'm, it was of Dodona, I believe, and not Delos, but I believe that there was something from Delos that contributed to Aphrodite's worship as well, and I'm just missing it. But the ideas of these water bird goddesses that, for instance, Mariha Gumbutas writes about in books like The Secret Language of the Goddess, influenced what became Aphrodite, what became the Mediterranean goddess of love, the Greek goddess of love. And so for, you know, is the idea that that the concept of Isis in Egypt and the concept of Aphrodite in Greece sort of melded into something new and different, you know,
mm-hmm.
created a new goddess that hadn't quite been seen before. I believe that that's absolutely possible, probable, and accurate. Yeah.
So you know, if I'm not getting too personal, do you have a particular ritual that you do for her during the year that you might want to share with listeners, or just your, what does it look like to be a priestess of Aphrodite? What do you do in the course of a day or a year that is maybe different from somebody who's not an Aphrodite priestess?
There are several things that I've done. Certainly my writing is part of it, but in terms of rituals, there are a few rituals that I try to lead every year, that I try to make sure that they're available to people that haven't worked with Aphrodite before, or people that have, but there's one in particular called the Aphrodisia, which is usually seen, it's a bathing ritual for Aphrodite, and it happens right around what would be the Greek New Year, which is in near the summer solstice. And so I've led that one several times, and I feel very strongly about continuing to lead it for people. You know, and I do that usually at festival. I've led that out at Starwood. I've led it a few times at our Haven Nature Sanctuary here in southern Indiana. There's also, I was given the opportunity this year to lead the Adonia, the funeral rites of Adonis, this year at Indianapolis Pagan Pride Day. And it was a wonderful and cathartic and very emotionally charged ritual, because we had, you know, the women dressing and preparing the body of Adonis, which for us was a dough man, a bread man that had fennel and sea salt incorporated into him. And then the men bore him to his rest. There's a ritual that I usually do fairly privately. Sometimes my family joins me with this, but I help maintain an Aphrodite shrine at our Haven, which is a nature sanctuary festival grounds that I've mentioned. And there's a beautiful, beautiful shrine there that was established by a friend of mine before I ever came around the land, and by my partner. They established it together, and it's situated so that it faces the planet Venus as she's descending, actually, on the horizon, on the western horizon.
So is it like a statue out in nature? Is that what it is?
There is now. There's a spiral pathway that's made up of a Chinese hedge bush of some sort that's been growing just over the last 4 or 5 years. It's really taken off. There's an altar in the middle that was established as a great rite altar, and then there's a shrine to the side within these hedges that at first it was just an altar area. You know, it was just a stone shrine with a few offerings on it. And here in the last few years, I've been really, really lucky, very fortunate to be able to help manifest that shrine even more. We have a statue out there now. We have climbing roses that were the funds for which were donated from a fellow Aphrodisian devotee in Nevada. Others have sent money to help us mulch. and put down pea gravel on the path and this kind of thing. So, and
so
it's a community endeavor.
Yeah.
It really is. It really is.
We have about 12 minutes left, so let me just ask you two last quick questions. If someone asked you, do you believe all the goddesses are one goddess, or if they're actually different energies, different essences, how would you answer?
It's tricky for me. I fluctuate on this question. I really do.
I understand that. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, depending on where I am in life and on my own path and what my circumstances are, I believe that ultimately, the universe and everything in it is a great spirit, one great spirit, and that we're all many spirits within that. And so, just as we are spirits within the universal spirit, I think that the same is true of the gods and goddesses.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the goddesses, that you could look at goddess just as goddess,
mm-hmm.
All-encompassing and everything. I think that it's also still possible within that to parse them out and to honor and recognize each individual goddess, to see her specific touch in your life.
Yeah.
And that those two things aren't really mutually exclusive.
I think that's a good point. It's almost like they can morph, I'm struggling to find the words here, but it's like they can be, one all-encompassing sort of element,
right.
but then, they can sort of break off when necessary, shall we say.
Right.
Or
yes.
As needed or whatever,
Yes, absolutely. Like everything and just one thing, but all at the same time.
Yeah, why have it be limiting? Well, let's close with what do you think, as you look to the future of Aphrodisian worship, what do you see? Or what do you hope?
I hope for, and I see more and more people coming together and bringing her rights into the world, bringing her love and her light. Just in the fairly recent past here, and this is definitely gaining momentum, there's an order of flame keepers for a flame related to Aphrodite, bringing her love and her passion, her guidance into the world. And we all maintain the flame on a schedule where we each take turns, but then we also all maintain the flame on the fourth day of the Greek month, the lunar solar month. I see more people writing about Aphrodite and about their experiences with her. I see even right now temples being established in places like Oakland, and in other places around this country, here in the U.S. and around the world, physical spaces where people can come and honor the goddess of love.
Now, are you seeing, are there men involved, or is it mostly women?
I would say it's predominantly women, but there are several men. Yes, definitely several men.
So they're priests of Aphrodite?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, Lorelei, we're about out of time, unfortunately. I always enjoy talking to you so much. It's a gift to me to chat with you. You really sort of, pique my curiosity and challenge my thinking, and I always like when people do that. I guess in closing, is there anything you'd like to share with listeners that maybe I've failed to ask you, or parting comments or thoughts?
No, I don't think so. I think we've covered everything pretty well on this particular topic, and I just want to thank you again for having me on. I really enjoy these opportunities to talk.
Well, you're welcome back anytime. If, something comes up, you want to chat about, or you have a new book, or you want to, talk, maybe before, maybe when we're in that part of the year when it's about to be her ritual or something, pop me an email, a month or two ahead so I can get you on the calendar, and, we'll know, maybe play some Aphrodite music and, you know, talk about her holy day and what's going to happen and stuff like that. It might inspire other people to do the same thing.
That sounds lovely. I would be honored to do that.
Okay, so we'll keep in touch. And one last thing before you go, please tell listeners again how they can reach you and all your wonderful books and work.
The books are available through AsteriaBooks.com. Asteria is A-S-T-E-R-I-A. And I also maintain a blog at aphroditespriestess.blogspot.com, where I write quite a lot about my magical adventures, we'll say, both about being a priestess of Aphrodite and also working in a general neo-pagan context.
Cool, very cool. I'll have to go read that. I love to read other people's experiences of goddess. Well, Lorelei, thank you so much. I'm so glad I was able to connect with you. We've had two really good shows, and I'm looking forward to, you know, having you back.
Thank you so much. I look forward to it, too.
Oh, you're welcome. Good night.
Good night.
Well, listeners, I hope you enjoyed these two wonderful priestesses that were on tonight. And as we get to the end of the show, you know what, pretty soon here I will be off the air. But as promised, I want to make sure I play Om Sekhmet by Abigail Spinner McBride in honor of Sekhmet, because we opened the show honoring Aphrodite. And both of these wonderful mothers, you know, need their tribute. But I want to tell you first that next week on the show we have with us Z Budapest. She's going to be discussing the subject of leadership. And after Z, we will have Anne Prashito Rich sharing her thoughts and insight on how awe and envy have shackled the sacred feminine. How awe and envy have shackled the sacred feminine. That sounds really interesting. I'm looking forward to that conversation a lot. So as we come to the closing of tonight's show, please remember that that Goddess teaches us what you nurture and tend to, it survives and thrives, and what you neglect, well, it will wither. And if you would, please remember, if you can, to send a donation to help keep Voices of the Sacred Feminine on the air. And a reminder that the show is looking for a like-minded sponsor, and we do commercials. So, good night, my dear friends, family, fans, and colleagues. May Goddess embrace you in her golden wings. Please come back next week, and thank you for your listener loyalty. And we will close out the show tonight with Om Sekhmet by Abigail Spinner McBride. Good night.